Hey, everybody, and welcome to another episode of your favorite movie podcast, F This Movie, the podcast that celebrates both the sour and the sweet. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I am joined tonight, after another considerable absence, and we miss him when he's gone, Mr. Alex Lawson from Virginia. How are you, sir?
Hey, I'm doing great. Yeah. Yes, another absence, not as prolonged as my previous absence.
No.
I'm glad to be back. I'm excited to talk about the movie we're talking about tonight.
Are you actually back, or is this just a lucid dream?
Oh, Jesus. Well, you've already started in with the teases.
With the nonsense. I'm nothing if not a tease. You can find our website at fthismovie.blogspot.com, and you can email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com, and you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and
all that shit.
Yeah, there's other MySpace, also Friendster. we're finally on Friendster.
You're getting really good at being, like, all jokes aside, you're getting really good at, like, just snapping that shit off and out very quickly.
Listen,
like,
I'm nothing if not good at snapping off. So you've been gone a long time, Alex, but I have to ask you a very important question.
The obligatory.
Does this make me look fat?
Only your head.
Okay.
It's fine, because that's actually all I can see right now.
Yeah.
Other than that, you look fantastic.
Have you seen anything good lately?
I have. I saw, not this weekend, but last weekend, I went and saw Source Code. I was just going to say I was so moved by it. I'm not going to say that.
Okay.
Even though I just did. It stirred up so many thoughts in me that I actually reached out to you and thought about doing a show on it. It's sort of hard because as I look back on it now, and I really, really like the movie, but I realize it is sort of hard to have a discussion about that without talking about some key plot points.
Yeah, that's true.
Particularly the last 15 or 20 minutes.
Yeah, and it's hard to do a new movie without – when we do new movies, we try to not spoil them because people haven't seen them yet.
Precisely.
Right.
Great
idea. That was a great idea.
Yeah, it was. It was fantastic. My primer on Source Code is I loved it a lot.
Okay.
And I was sort of nervous when I saw the trailer because it looks, but like in hindsight, it sort of seems like it's maybe a hard movie to kind of market other than just a straight up like action thriller sort of thing. But I mean, we all love Moon. We were all very excited for the follow-up to Moon. And then when I saw that this was the guy who directed Moon, Duncan Jones, Little Bowie, as I call him.
Sure. Lil'IL.
No. Baby Bowie.
Oh, Baby Bowie. Got
Baby Bowie. Sorry. Yeah.
Much better.
I thought, well, that's interesting that he's doing something more commercial or whatever. And anyway, like without spoiling it, I liked it. In hindsight, as I've looked at it, I realized they maybe sort of fumbled the last 15 or so minutes of that movie.
Yeah.
Maybe more than I was willing to admit when I walked out of the theater. But I still really liked it. It's one of the best things I've seen this year, which, by the way, don't look now, but we're like a third of the way through 2011. It's not too soon to start like recounting things that you've liked. And I've really only liked like two things. I liked Source Code. And I also liked Rango, which I saw 2 or 3 weeks ago. Which I think was an interesting thing for Gore Verbinski, who is a guy who was always sort of one of those like talented, but like without any sort of substance or style directors,
right,
like a director for hire or whatever.
Right.
I like both of those. I suspect most people who are listening have seen Source Code by now, but if you haven't, you should check it out.
I have so many thoughts based on what you just said.
Go ahead.
It is. I can't believe it's already almost May. We're already almost into the summer movie season. I think Thor comes out in a week or two. And
I was going to say, is that going to be your Iron Man 2 this year? Is that when summer starts?
I mean, it's the first week of May, you know, at this point. So I guess I could push it back to like Fast 5, but I refuse to.
Sure.
Thor, I guess, is sort of the kickoff of the summer season. And, you know, overall this year, I mean, I recognize that not a lot of great movies have come out, but I've seen three or four things that I've really liked and could conceivably end up on my year-end list. And even stuff I haven't loved, like I saw Hannah, and I didn't love Hannah, and I saw Your Highness, and I didn't love Your Highness, but I appreciate that both exist. Source Code, kind of the same thing, although I would argue Source Code is maybe a better movie than those other two. They're just different enough to not be like everything else that comes out, that we're getting sort of studio movies that take some chances, and I like that, and I suspect it's about to go away as we enter the glut of, like, sequels and cartoons and all that kind of nonsense, but I'm happy that the first quarter of the year, there's been a number of things that, again, even if I didn't love, I appreciate that it exists.
And there is something to be said, because you just said, like, we're about to enter probably a period of lowbrow, you know, by the numbers entertainment or whatever as the summer season kicks off.
But also Super 8.
Yeah, well, yes, of course. But it stands to reason also that, like, the first 4 months of the year aren't exactly prime cinema territory either. And we've gotten, like you said, some pretty good things. Now you just mentioned, too, that you had seen recently and liked. Is there anything you've seen that you care to speak at length about, either one of those two, or
no, Your Highness is like a movie that it just, again, I'm happy that it exists, because what a weird movie to come out of a major studio. And I understand what they were going for. I think it's just a few good jokes away from being like a Hot Fuzz or a Shaun of the Dead, in that it's like, it is this, it's the thing that it's not even necessarily spoofing the fantasy genre. It just basically is like a fantasy movie. It just needed better jokes, because the jokes that do exist at best are kind of like, you chuckle a little bit. It's like the funniest jokes in the movie should have been like the throwaway jokes between all the really big laughs. There's never any really big laughs. It's all just,
it doesn't ever crescendo.
Never.
Or anything.
It's just,
I,
like,
haven't seen it. So I'm going off of what you're saying.
But I didn't hate it, and I'm amazed at the reaction to that movie. I mean, people are beating the shit out of that movie. I just don't think it deserves it, but that's me. And Hannah, you know, is real uneven. When Hannah is good, it's really good. It's like, this is a cool take on an action movie, and Joe Wright does some really cool stuff. He's never made a movie that I've particularly loved, and I guess still hasn't, but I like seeing his sensibility applied to an action movie. But it just gets bogged down in, like, a lot of wandering around and Hannah discovering, like, the outside world, and he shoehorns in all this stuff that, like, he has to beat you over the head with, this is a fairy tale, it's a fairy tale, it's a fairy tale, and it's like, we get it. That doesn't make it a better movie. Just because you have created some sort of context for this doesn't mean that it works. It just means there's a context for it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no.
It's not definitely. It's not necessarily a particularly good fairy tale. It's just like, look, I can spot fairy tale signifiers. But again, I'm happy that it exists. It's different enough from, you know, other action movies that come out. So
yeah. I think they're going to put that on the Blu-ray box.
Perhaps.
When it comes out.
Different enough.
It's different enough. Yeah. I'm glad it exists, says Patrick Bromley of this movie. I haven't seen either of those, but I'm going to shortly, because I want to, and I want to, you know, and again, to sort of cross-promote, I want to quickly plug the on the website, you have a write-up of Super, which I haven't seen yet, but I was incredibly intrigued by your review, and it was probably something I was going to see anyway, but it sounds like that's something that's, again, well, I said it about Source Code, but it seems like it's being marketed a little differently than what it actually is.
Yeah, they're definitely trying to market sort of a wacky guy tries to be a superhero comedy.
And which has been done.
Right, I mean, definitely. Yeah. But it's, you know, but now it's Dwight from The Office. Haha, what a nerd.
Right.
And the audience that I saw it with, as JB pointed out on, I think, the Scream podcast, desperately wanted it to be that movie. But it very quickly is not that movie, and they were resisting the movie that it was. So it was an interesting sort of disconnect. But yeah, it's really good and really interesting, and it's on demand now. I went to the Music Box to see it because it's a very limited release, but it's now on demand.
No kidding.
So you don't even have to go out to a theater to see it.
Cool. I guess can we say 2011 off to an okay start?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Just in the last couple of weeks. I mean, I really was on a run up until Scream 4. I liked Sucker Punch a lot. I saw The Devil. I saw Source Code.
You mean Super?
No, I mean Sucker Punch.
Sorry.
I liked Sucker Punch. I saw The Devil. Source Code, Super, Your Highness, Hannah, again, just different enough. And it wasn't really until I saw Scream 4 that the streak kind of was broken.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but we don't have to go into it. Yeah, you did a whole nice, lovely podcast.
Yeah, but for a while it was like, I'm seeing some decent to really good stuff, you know?
Cool.
Source Code, I liked. I had a lot of problems with it. Not just the ending, but in particular the ending.
Yeah. What were your problems outside of the ending? Just to be brief, because we should probably get to the meat of the stuff here.
Yeah,
just
right.
Briefly.
I mean, again, I can't get into too much without spoiling it. I thought the tone was a little off. I thought some of the attempts at humor fell flat. I thought some of them were great. I liked some of the stuff Jake Gyllenhaal did. I liked him a lot. I like Michelle Monaghan pretty much all the time.
Sure.
But like the Russell Peters stuff not working. I thought some of the effects were really spotty. I thought, you know, that the movie is essentially supposed to be a mystery. And I don't know if Duncan Jones just wasn't interested in it being a mystery, but he really did not work very hard at all to make it compelling as a mystery. Whether or not that was his intent, I don't know. But to me, it was very, very obvious from the first few minutes of the movie, sort of who the guy is that he's looking for. So then we're just spending an hour and a half. Like it's the equivalent of watching the horror movie and watching the person go in the house when they shouldn't go in the house. It's just like, we know you're wrong. How many times do we have to sit through this?
Yeah. I mean, I had an inkling too, and I understand that criticism in that I actually had the guy, as it were, sort of pegged. Like they do it a little on the nose, but
yeah.
I think but I think the way that it ended up playing out, the tone of the thing made that whole part of it seem a little secondary to me.
Right.
And that all that actually mattered was that Jake Gyllenhaal didn't know. And so but I know they weren't playing it in a way that it's like, you know, something the character doesn't like.
Right. And I agree with what you're saying, but I also would say that for that to work, for the movie that you're describing to work, that Jake Gyllenhaal's realization or his figuring it out should also be sort of life-changing for the character, that he's only able to see the truth when he comes to some sort of realization and not just sort of a process of elimination, which is what the movie ends up being.
Okay. I mean, I guess that makes sense. I promise we'll move on here. I guess what really intrigued me about it was again, based on what I had seen going in, and like, of course, like, you know, when you watch movies these days, like you very rarely are able to watch anything with like a clean slate, and you have a certain amount of context going in based on what you've seen in trailers and whatnot. But like, I was really intrigued that there were then, and again, not giving too much away, but like there's two big mysteries that you're trying that you're sort of presented with.
Right.
And that other second one that he's dealing with was not even on my radar.
Okay.
And I thought it was admirable the way that they sort of intersected and that he could only sort of do, he could do one to lead to the other.
Right.
And I thought that was an interesting way to tell that story. Mm-hmm. But your points are eloquent. And,
as always. Again, yeah. I did like Source Code, and it's a great example of a what could have been sort of a standard studio thriller
done with
intelligence. And it's nice to see a talented guy like Duncan Jones coming in and bringing something to a movie that could have been very by the numbers. The on the Slash Filmcast, the guys pointed out, they were talking about the critical reaction to Source Code and how everyone has just really embraced that movie, and critics were falling all over themselves talking about how great it was. And one person said, well, maybe it's just the dearth of quality movies that when one comes along that's good, people freak out. And another guy pointed to that maybe it's this year's The Town. It's just like, no, every movie should be as good as Source Code or as The Town. And so, but so few movies are that when one comes along that is, it seems so much better than it actually might be. But again, you can look at something like Tony Scott's Deja Vu, which is a very similar movie.
Yeah.
But one works and one doesn't. So,
Yep.
I don't know. Let's talk about tonight's movie, 2001's Vanilla Sky, directed by Cameron Crowe. Yeah. This is obviously an interesting movie. It's a remake of a 1997 movie called Abre los Ojos, Open Your Eyes.
Which you have seen and I have not.
Yes, just, directed by Alejandro Amenábar. And, you know, this is one of those movies we've been talking lately on If This Movie about. I think we talked about it with Sucker Punch, and we talked about it a long time ago with Funny People. When a director builds up enough goodwill, he's able to make a movie that he would have otherwise never been able to make. And Vanilla Sky, I think, is very much that movie for Cameron Crowe, that Jerry Maguire was a big hit, Almost Famous was not necessarily a huge commercial hit, but a big critical hit, and was nominated for Oscars, and he won an Oscar. And so he's able to make this movie that feels very little like anything else Cameron Crowe had done before.
I could not agree more, and I'm glad that you decided to start there, because Vanilla Sky was a movie that I suggested to you.
Yes.
I really wanted to talk about it because it's a movie I've seen a lot, but I hadn't seen in a long time, which is, you know, things I've suggested to you in the past have fit that mold as well. Yeah. And I just wanted to give it another watch and, you know, talk about it in this forum. I don't know what this says about the movie itself, but I'm always more fascinated, as even more than what actually happens in the movie, I'm more fascinated with like how it fits into Cameron Crowe's canon, because, I mean, this is, like you said, straight after Almost Famous, which is just like, and I love Almost Famous, and most people do, and it's gained a lot, you know, more traction as, you know, the years have gone on, and even with Jerry Maguire too, and then Jerry Maguire's a movie that has some problems, but I still sort of like, but I mean. It's just, I mean, this movie is just a complete left turn in tone and in storytelling and, you know, the way the characters all sort of fit together. But yeah, I mean, it is, like you said, just sort of an example of a guy building up a lot of, you know, cachet. And then maybe this is a reflection of what happened with Vanilla Sky, but... Did Elizabeth Town come straight after this? Was that his next thing?
Yeah.
Yeah. See, now that says something, I think, about like what Vanilla Sky means for his career. I think it represents something of a creative tipping point. You're telling good story after good story after good story. And by the way, spoiler alert for this F This Movie podcast, I like Vanilla Sky a lot still. But this is a movie where I think like, you get to a certain point of storytelling where people who were so with you are then no longer with you.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of oversimplifying, and we'll go into it in more detail. But I mean, I think that's a good way to couch the discussion in terms of like a guy who was making sort of smaller scale, just people stories about people sort of talking and interacting, and this is about that too, but in a on a whole other level.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
Yeah. It's, you know, Vanilla Sky was, I mean, sort of a commercial success. I want to say it grossed over $100 million because
probably, yeah,
again,
I think that's right.
Tom Cruise had that ability to just drag a movie to box office success. But it was obviously a very sort of polarizing movie critically and with audiences. And I think actually, you know, most people sort of rejected it largely because it was not like anything Cameron Crowe had done before. And a lot of people rejected it. And I don't know if that's what inspired him to sort of try and go back to the well. Elizabeth Town feels very much like a guy trying to approximate a Cameron Crowe movie. Just sort of this, it just is drowning in flop sweat. And, it doesn't work, and he has his next movie is coming out this year. Finally,
I was saying, and that's the first one since Elizabeth Town, right?
Yeah.
We're going on like 7 years or something.
Vanilla Sky, yeah, is 10 years old, which blows my mind.
Yeah, yeah, that is really crazy.
Yeah, and then he's only made one movie since, so he's made one movie in 10 years. But yeah, Vanilla Sky obviously is a dark, often cold, often almost angry movie, and those aren't things that you necessarily associate with Cameron Crowe. I'm a big Cameron Crowe fan. I don't love Elizabeth Town. And I've had this weird relationship with Vanilla Sky because it's exactly the kind of movie that I'm forever championing on F This Movie, which is the ambitious mess, you know, that it's not for everybody, but it has a lot of ideas and it really tries certain things and they may not all work, but boy, don't we appreciate the effort and the willingness to really lay yourself out there.
Yeah.
In watching it for this podcast, I did a weird thing, because I, like you, I haven't seen it in a couple of years. When I first sat down to watch it, I watched it with the Cameron Crowe audio commentary.
Oh my god! I am so glad that you said, because I was going to mention the commentary track later on.
Okay,
go ahead.
If you're a fan of Vanilla Sky and you've never listened to the commentary track, I suggest you do. If only because it pretty much gives away any of the movie's secrets. If you find it, if you're confused by Vanilla Sky, and we'll get to why you probably shouldn't be confused by Vanilla Sky later.
Yeah, absolutely not.
you know, Cameron Crowe pretty much lays it all out there. So I sat down, I watched it with the commentary track, and I found myself not really liking Vanilla Sky. Largely because I felt like so much of what Cameron Crowe was saying wasn't in the movie, that it was just sort of this pretentious mix of big ideas, but never actually explore. He just keeps throwing out words like it's about love and death and dreams and nightmares. It's like, well, in what way? You can't just keep throwing out these big, heady buzzwords, but your movie doesn't necessarily address those except for on the surface, big level way. So all of a sudden I was like, maybe I don't really like Vanilla Sky anymore. And then I watched Abre los Ojos. Mm-hmm. And then immediately after, watched Vanilla Sky again.
You were pulling overtime for this podcast. That is yeoman's work.
Yeah,
that's impressive.
And again, it changed the way I looked at Vanilla Sky, because I didn't realize, having never seen Abre los Ojos, how much of a faithful remake the movie is. I mean, it's almost like a let the right one in, let me in situation, where it's just like, gosh, what's the point? You almost made the exact same movie again.
No kidding.
But he threw some Cameron Crowe stuff into it. And ultimately, I think that stuff wins me over to the point where, I mean, Abre los Ojos is a much more sort of streamlined version of the same movie.
And again, I have not seen it, but if I were to speculate, is most of the Cameron Crowe stuff that you're talking about, is that like a lot of this, if I were to guess, and tell me if I'm wrong, because again, I haven't seen it, but like, is that a lot of this like pop culture influence?
Yes.
Like how it informs our world and stuff?
Or which is one of the things I always liked about Vanilla Sky. So seeing it again, I was like, no, I do like Vanilla Sky for a lot of the reasons that we're talking about, because I do feel like he brought something to it. And in the same way that, you know, Almost Famous is such a personal movie for him because it's basically his life story.
Sure.
I think Vanilla Sky is also incredibly personal for the reasons that you're stating. And I'm sure we'll get to it again, but I just want to throw it out there now before I forget. Spoilers for Vanilla Sky if you haven't seen it throughout this podcast. So,
Crying out loud, it's 10 years old.
Yeah, if you do want to see the movie, you really should, because it's interesting, even if you don't like it. And if you have seen it, please keep listening, or if you don't care about it being spoiled. I had forgotten – I like all the pop culture stuff he threw in there. I had forgotten the fact that at the end of the movie, Noah Taylor just flat out spells out every reference, and I don't like that.
Well, there is – yeah. Well, that's part of the problem with the ending of Pulp Fiction – or Pulp Fiction.
I agree. No, Pulp Fiction has a flawed ending.
Goddamn. A Vanilla Sky, I thought of Pulp Fiction because that is another thing that uses a lot of cultural sort of spot the reference or whatever. But anyway.
Family Guy, basically. It's
the definitely.
It's the problem with Family Guy.
Yeah, it's the manatees making the jokes. Yeah, no. I'm mixing so many
references. Yeah, you are. But I'm keeping up. Don't worry.
Yeah, no, good. Well, if anyone else is, God bless you. No, that's part of the problem with the end of Vanilla Sky and it has struck me before, and it struck me again, where it's a massive exposition dump in a way that even transcends. I can deal with a certain amount of exposition dump, but yeah, that's overkill a little bit. Like, especially when he talk, like if you didn't get the Bob Dylan, you know, reference, or, you know, even the actual Vanilla Skies that they're talking about. And he says under these, whatever he says, like these Monet like skies. I'm like,
yeah, can well, you give us this much credit, you know,
that's a problem. Yeah. But that doesn't, by no means does that really like torpedo anything that came before it. Because I still enjoy, not like trying to like, I don't make like a game out of it or anything, because I don't think anything is really shoehorned in there. I actually like think a lot of the stuff that's in there serves a purpose and is in there for a reason. I think a lesser filmmaker that would have like tried to tell a story this way would have like just like thrown a lot of pop culture shit into the movie for the sake of like making a movie about pop culture or something. But a lot of the things that he chooses to highlight like resonates with me.
I'm going to almost argue against myself here, because I do like all the pop culture stuff, but at the same time, A, it's really the only different thing that Cameron Crowe brings to the movie, and B, I understand what he's going for, and I even agree with it, because he's basically, you know, if the movie's about this guy who's been in this dream state for 150 years, and, you know, in the construction of this new reality that he's built over the last 150 years, it's built, you know, from his memories, but so many of his memories are sort of couched in pop culture, you know, and I think it's true of either one of us. If one of us was, you know, in a coma tomorrow, so much of what would be going on would be informed by movies and TV shows that we've seen.
Yeah.
So he sticks that in there, but I don't know how much he really explores it. If it's the only thing he adds to the movie, he doesn't really expound on that idea. He just sort of says like, oh yeah, and we do this too. It's not necessarily about our relationship to that pop culture, just that it informs our lives.
I guess I mean, I don't disagree with what you're saying. I guess I always thought it's a reflection of his like profession as an editor of what seems to be a very prominent like publishing you know, empire that like deals in like capitalizing on people's interests in culture. And I think that's maybe I'm giving it a little too much credit there, because you're right, it maybe is a little bit underexplored, but that's always how I've sort of explained its presence in there. I mean, he is a guy who you can tell by that terrific birthday party scene,
right,
in his apartment, like everybody is just absorbed by all of these things and like, you know, cultural touchstones that he like has on display in his whole life.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that delivers enough on that for me.
Well, he's definitely made out to be a guy who consumes a tremendous amount of pop culture, but aren't we all?
Yeah.
Especially we, the audience for a Cameron Crowe movie. I mean,
yeah, maybe, yeah, you know. That's a good point. I guess I don't disagree with what you're saying, but I feel like it's just it's pulled off in such a way that that has never been something that like gave me pause.
It really wasn't until today when I noticed. I had forgotten just how explicitly those things are spelled out. That's really my issue, more than the fact that they're in there. I like the shot of him and Penelope Cruz walking down the alley, and it's the Freewheeling Bob Dylan. I like that. I want to be able to figure out that he's constructed Kurt Russell as an Atticus Finch character, as this sort of guiding father figure, without Noah Taylor telling me, you know, you've created this guy to be like Gregory Peck, the father you never had. Just like, no, I got that. I don't need you to, even at the end, and this isn't a pop culture thing, but it's like when his last move is to jump off the building, when that's how he's going to wake up, he says, oh, and I probably came up with this too, right? And Noah Taylor's like, yeah, your one last challenge to get over your fear of heights. Like, oh yeah, my gosh, yeah. I got it. It bums me out. The movie is like so afraid of being ambiguous. I mean, it spends almost 2 hours being incredibly ambiguous and like what's going on, and you're displaced in time and reality. And then in the last 10 minutes is like, just in case there was any doubt, guys, let me lay it all out for you. And that's a bummer.
Yeah. It is a bummer. It is, however, not something that is deal breaker for me.
No, me either.
Yeah. I want to talk about one thing that struck me again on this viewing, and God, I shudder to say this because it is, stick with me here, because it like, this is going to sound like such a generic compliment to a movie, but I really want you to think about what I'm saying. I was struck this time with, and Cameron Crowe's a terrific writer. He always has been. The economy of the characters in the movie. I would argue that there's not one single character in this movie that is like misused or misplaced or anything like that. I feel like everybody is given a specific function, particularly the two women.
Yeah.
And
again, keep in mind, not to debunk what you're saying, but that does not come from Cameron Crowe.
Right. And this is certainly a testament to just the idea as a concept. Mm-hmm. But there is something to be said for, like, even if you have great source material, there is something to be said for, like, I mean, we can only look to like the shot for shot remake of Psycho to know that like you can still fuck that up.
Right.
I did not realize until this viewing how much like those two female characters, Cameron Diaz, and by the way, the best she's ever been in anything, right?
Yeah. Yeah. We'll come back to that.
Okay. And Penelope Cruz, I'm not even saying like they're like tentpole female cinema characters, like an Ellen Ripley or a Scarlett O'Hara or something. But I mean, like, cause they're not that well developed, but there's a reason, because like, I like the way that they give David Ames, Tom Cruise's character, like the way they shape him as a guy. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Like, I'm not being terribly eloquent and I apologize. Like the way they shape him as a guy, put that on the DVD box.
Nice.
But I was really struck this time for whatever reason by just the way like it could totally make sense given where he is in his life to be with one of them. And then of course it makes even more perfect sense for him to just be with the other one now. Mm-hmm. It really struck me. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was really well executed by all parties, Cameron Crowe and the actors. So
it's a great movie to watch if you like actors, because every single part, down to the smallest role, is filled with somebody recognizable, somebody that you know, somebody that you like. There's Timothy Spall, there's Tilda Swinton, there's Alicia Witt for no reason. There's, you know, Jason Lee when he was still awesome. And I agree with you. And again, Vanilla Sky is such a roller coaster for me and continues to be, and here's why. When I saw the movie in 2001, I was not a Penelope Cruz fan at all.
Neither was I.
I didn't understand what she brought to any movie. I resented the fact that she was one of these people like a Matthew McConaughey or a Sam Worthington where it's just like, she's a movie star. Like, no, I have to decide that because I hadn't seen a lot of her Spanish work. So I was not a fan. And seeing it again, I'm much more of a Penelope Cruz fan. I actually really like her now. And so I do like her in the movie, and I think she makes certain moments work better than anybody else I could think of would. But I have some problems, and they're Cameron Crowe's problems. Let me come back to that real quick. Cameron Diaz breaks my heart, because up until, I guess, Vanilla Sky, I thought she was so interesting as an actress, because, you know, she came out in The Mask, and that movie has its problems, but it's one of those performances where you're just like, oh my God, who is that?
Exactly. It's a head turner. I mean,
right,
like,
she's great hot, looking, and she does great with the does great with the comedy, and she's got that dance scene, and you're just like, my God, who is that? You could see a movie star being born.
Yes. Of course.
And then she spends the next 5 or 6 years basically doing like character actress parts. She has obviously leading woman looks, but she's doing these character actress parts in movies like Very Bad Things or She's the One or My Best Friend's Wedding. she makes different choices. And when she makes like a lead role, it's in something like A Life Less Ordinary. And it's just like, it's out there, you know? And it's really not until Charlie's Angels, and Vanilla Sky, I think, did come after Charlie's Angels. So Vanilla Sky was sort of the end of it. But Charlie's Angels was really the point where, oh, now she's the worst. Now she's not interested in doing things that are interesting anymore.
Yeah.
But she is so effing good in Vanilla Sky. And I remember a few different critics groups, possibly even the Golden Globes, noticed that. And I want to say the Chicago Film Critics, which for a long time was so good about getting it right in a way that other critics groups weren't. They would always find somebody that you're like, yeah, you guys noticed that. They singled her out for Best Supporting Actress. I don't think she won, but she might have been nominated. Maybe she won. I don't know. But she's so good. She's such a real person.
Mm-hmm.
And you understand everything about her, and you don't even blame her for a lot of what she does.
I could not agree more.
Yeah.
And I my thoughts about Cameron Diaz are very similar to yours. In that, yeah, I mean, it was pretty clear that she had the chops or whatever to like make it in the business. I'm going to roll out every Hollywood cliche that there is, by the way. You know, she had, but at no point did I ever really think like, what a great actress. You know what
right,
I mean? Like,
right,
like, in,
right.
Like in the way that like, I knew I liked watching her and things. And like, you did not mention Something About Mary, which is a movie I know you love, but I mean, she's great in that movie too. But again, not a great like
right.
thespian achievement, right?
Right, right.
And this is a little more showy, but it's not even showy in a way that like Sean Penn and Mystic River is showy. Like,
right. I mean, everything she does is pretty subtle.
It's so good, and yeah, you put it very well in saying that she is such a real person. Mm-hmm. In that, like, I feel like you've always. I don't know what this says about me as a person, but I feel like we've like known people at least like that. Maybe not to that extreme that what she ends up doing or whatever, but just people who are like attractive but sad and just insecure.
Yeah.
And she just, I mean, I don't know where any of that comes from. I've never been so engaged by a performance from her in anything else.
Right,
maybe
she creates a whole backstory without having to have some monologue about her life or what she's done, or, you know, like, but you get who she is as a person.
She, again, and forgive me for dusting off the, you know, actorly metaphors, but she is just inhabiting that person.
Yeah.
Like, she just is from the moment that you first see her, like when they're in bed together and she just like wakes him up and you know, she's just sort of like, they just have this like casual sex relationship or whatever. And it's like, oh, well, she seems cool with it and he seems cool with it. But then even like, obviously there are parts of the performance that are very showy and you know what they are. And if you've seen the movie, you know what they are. But like, even in that first scene, like you get the sense from what she does and the way she looks at him and the way she talks that it means a little bit more to her than it does to him.
Right.
And that plants the seeds for a lot of all the stuff that ends up happening. It's great. I cannot say enough good things about her. It's great.
And Vanilla Sky, in most respects, has it all over the Amin Arbar original in character development, that the characters are all better developed, including David Ames, who obviously is named, I think, Cesar in the original. Because the part, you know, the Julie Gianni part in the original film is very much just sort of a type. She's just got like short dark hair and she just kind of glares and she's just sort of like, oh, she's trouble, but in like a generic kind of a way.
Is it like noirish almost?
No, not necessarily. But it's just to look at her, you know that, oh, she's the opposite of Penelope Cruz.
Yeah.
And I mean, obviously, there's some of that in Vanilla Sky just in their appearances. But you don't get the sense that like that they were cast as types.
Yeah.
So Cameron Diaz has it all over that other girl. And Penelope Cruz is playing the same part in both movies.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a very different part. And in some respects, I kind of like what she does in Abre Los Ojos better, only because, and again, the movies are interested in two very different things. Because in the original film, she's really just like this normal girl who kind of hits it off with a guy and could maybe have a second date, and ends up not because of the way things work out. You know, he has a car accident, he's disfigured, blah, 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 blah. And she's much more just kind of normal, and I kind of like that. And that's not her performance necessarily. It's what what she's asked to do. Because one of my issues with Vanilla Sky, and again, it's all over the place because this movie is a roller coaster. I think Cameron Crowe tries too hard in those initial scenes between Tom Cruise and Penelope Cruz to sell us on this idea of two characters falling in love in one night.
Mm-hmm.
I think he pushes too hard to make her like this quirky bohemian artist who's filled with cute expressions that charm Tom Cruise. I think he wants us to feel at the end like this great love has been lost, even though they only knew each other a very short time.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish he would have pushed more towards having lost the possibility of great love. And in some respects, he does. When we get to the end and they're standing on that roof together, I think it's very, very moving. And she doesn't say a word. And again, that's where you're getting your money's worth out of Penelope Cruz, because she's able to do it on her face. And when I didn't like her, that didn't move me at all. And now I like her, and I think that's great stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I wish, you know, again, the original film is more content to just sort of let things play. Mm-hmm. And Cameron Crowe really wants to sell you that, like, no, these two fell in love in one night. And I don't I don't buy it, because I feel in the same way that, like, Tom Cruise and Cameron Diaz are sort of playing boyfriend girlfriend, and they're both aware of it. They joke around kind of at the beginning of the movie, and they're kind of play acting.
Yeah.
In one respect, I feel like that same thing is happening with him and Penelope Cruz, and I don't think that's deliberate.
Nothing you said is incorrect.
Thank you.
Yeah. But you've shown a propensity to do that. I think the seventh or eighth time, I haven't seen Abre los Ojos, okay? I haven't seen it, so I don't have anything to compare it to, but even to me, it plays a little heavy-handed. Like, I understand what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
And what is the – God, I can't remember what that guy from the AV Club – you mentioned this on the Garden State podcast. What's the Natalie Portman type?
The Manic Pixie Dream Girl?
There's a little bit of that going on,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay, the Manic Pixie Dream Girl, like, there's a little bit of that going on in terms of, like, what she's supposed to mean to him and all that.
Right.
There is one scene, however, that sells it for me. Everything that you just said he's trying too hard to make work, there's one scene that sells it, and it is the scene where they kiss, and then he leaves, and she, like, I forget which song it is. Great soundtrack in this movie, by the way. Not surprising.
Is this when he goes into the alley and gets in the car?
Yeah.
With Cameron Diaz?
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's Last Goodbye.
Yeah, there you go. Not surprisingly, great music in the movie.
Right.
But he leaves, the song swells up, and he lets the camera just linger on her for a second, and she, the girl who has been playing it too cool the entire time, sort like, you know, to the point where she, like, you sort of felt like she was maybe keeping her guard up, and then, you know, they kiss, and that's obviously, that's letting your guard down, obviously. But then even more so, he leaves, and then she just, like, she does that great move where she just, like, brings her legs up onto the couch and covers her face, and she just starts, like, she does the Laura Linney Love Actually move, you know, 2 years before Laura Linney did it in Love Actually. Like, she just, like, sort of freaks out because, like, a boy she liked kissed her, and, like, she runs over to the window and all that. Maybe I'm a bleeding heart romantic or something, but, man, I, like, that does it for me. Because, like, I mean, maybe it's oversimplifying and maybe I'm giving it way too much credit, but in that moment I'm just like, oh, I mean, that's all I need to see. And then, of course, like, what makes all of that work is then the sledgehammer that hits you in the next beat when he gets in the car with Cameron Diaz.
But yeah, like, watching the movie after having seen it a couple times, that scene is hard to watch because he does I'm not as infatuated with her little runaway as you are, although it is an interesting mirror to when he does the exact same thing earlier in the movie with Cameron Diaz, where we're on Tom Cruise, and real quickly we just cut back to something she's doing in the apartment,
yep.
And then we cut back to Tom Cruise. But I love when he walks out into that alley. I mean, the music and the sky and what's just happened. I mean, everybody, again, who... You know, Cameron Crowe makes, I think, movies that appeal to very specific kinds of people. And there are the kind of people whose lives are built by pop culture, like we talked about. And everybody, you know, has sort of their own movie going on in their head all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
And if they just kiss this girl that they like for the first time and they're walking out to their alley, walking out to their car early in the morning, the sky looks a certain way. That's the song that you're hearing in your head. And you're just like, this is this scene in my movie.
That's what it would feel like.
Yeah. Right. And he nails that moment. And then to juxtapose that with, and it breaks my heart at the end of the movie when he says, I shouldn't have gotten into the car with her.
Oh my God. I know.
Yeah, I lost you. I lost you when I got in the car with her.
As soon as I got in that car, it's just like, oh man, like he's right. And
right. And you see it happening again, having seen the movie in that moment, you're just like, oh my gosh. I mean, everything would be so different. And the movie is great sometimes, as much as, you know, I feel like some of that romance is artificial, which is a surprise because Cameron Crowe is the guy who did that Say Anything. I mean, that first date between Lloyd and Diane where he moves the glass, like that's all it took. It wasn't a bunch of like cutesy dialogue and little exchanges and In Another Life When We Are Both Cats and all that nonsense. Like it was just this one little gesture and that told us everything.
Yeah.
So he was, we know he's got it in him, but he was pushing it a little too hard. But at the same time, I feel like he does some of the painful stuff so well in this movie. I mean, that whole scene later in the movie, jumping ahead, when he goes out to the bar with Jason Lee and Penelope Cruz.
Oh, that's actually exactly where I was going to move the discussion. So
it's,
so good
it's
job.
So hard to watch. And I mean, I've been in that situation before, obviously not, you know, disfigured and out on this weird date.
No,
with
I don't
a friend.
Because you look really handsome.
This is my face. This is just
my
face.
Oh, very.
Yeah.
It's a little different.
But just sort of that misery of like,
yeah,
the girl's no longer interested in you or something's weird between you, but you can't talk about it for some reason because your friend is there or because the place is too loud or whatever. And it's just, and when they leave and it's like, yeah, we'll talk, but you know, we're not going to, and not just because I'm going to, you know, kill myself and go to sleep for 150 years. Like
Jason Lee actually says something terrific that kind of typifies that whole dynamic that you're talking about. When they leave the club, like they've all been out together, and you know, there's that weird, like, you know, Jason Lee met her first and he liked her, and then you know the two of them hit it off, and then he just says in that great Jason Lee delivery that he has, like he just says we'll call you, like that's what's happening now,
right.
It's the like the three of us are going like,
yeah,
like,
it's like, I'll call you. I'll call you so we can go out or something like that. Like,
yeah. Oh, it's so fucked up. Like, yeah. Yeah. That scene struck me in that way too, in a way that it did before. Like I feel like whenever I watched it before, it just struck me as, oh, here's that weird part of this movie. Like maybe that wasn't hitting me on the level that I thought. And we talk about this a lot in the podcast about how you rewatch things and you gain new perspective.
Right.
And it's not in the sense of like you change your opinion, so that means you're backpedaling or flip flopping or something. You get older and you experience life in certain ways and you have certain experiences that inform the way you see similar experiences played out before you. It's very logical. Yeah, I mean, that's that whole scene, like that weird ass music and those and the lights, and like he gets too drunk and the lingering close ups on his fucked up face. Like
it's a very unpleasant sequence to watch.
Yeah.
A lot of the movie is very unpleasant, and again, you don't associate that with Cameron Crowe, but at the same time, I think a lot of, as douchey as it is to say something like emotional truth, I think there's a lot of, beyond sort of the what's happening in the plot, because that's not necessarily something most of us can relate to. But I think a lot of what the characters are going through still remains very relatable, despite sort of this goofy sci-fi premise.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And actually, again, this leads me to sort of apologize for the thing that you were complaining about before, which is their sort of like overly ham-fisted witty banter that they have at the party.
Yeah.
I mean, and again, if I'm giving him too much credit and you think that, just tell me and we can weather the storm or whatever. But like, I feel like it's really ballsy to have them have this dialogue that seems very overly written, to use a lazy verb. But like, you know, it seems very written when they're talking about like, you know, there's a girl, you know, who I have a stalker, and, you know, she's burning a hole in my back, isn't she? That all seems sort of, like I said, ham-fisted. But then, like, to have the balls to present that in a way that it's then, like, almost parodying itself when he is, like, trying to...
Well, it's desperate.
Yeah, right. But, I mean, it's desperate, like, in the, like, within the arc of the story, like, right, the way he's trying to... Maybe I'm not communicating it very well. I mean from like a filmmaking perspective, I think that it, and again, like I said, too much credit, I don't know. But I feel like that almost excuses the overly cute sentiments in that, like, he tries to actually say, like, yeah, you know, he tries to, like, sort of bring it back and say, like, people make fun of their own cuteness sometimes. I don't know. I mean, and again, maybe it's too much. Like, again, if you're like grasping at straws to like rekindle a connection or something. And I think that that's why that's in the movie in the first place.
Yeah, maybe. I you know, you may be giving Cameron Crowe a lot of credit there, but
as I've been prone to do. I mean, I love Jerry Maguire still. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Even lines like, that's not a dress, that's an Audrey Hepburn movie.
Oh, come on. I mean, listen, we don't need to make this the Jerry Maguire podcast. Jerry Maguire is not a movie that has aged terribly well.
Yeah.
Not even just in aesthetics, but in like lines like that.
Right.
But I mean,
I still like Jerry Maguire. And again, Jerry Maguire is one of those source codes or the towns where it's just like, no, that's a good example of what a movie should be. You know, I don't know that it's Cameron Crowe's best movie.
No, I don't think so.
Although we could debate what Cameron Crowe's best movie is. It's not Elizabethtown.
It's not that.
We should probably talk about Tommy C in Vanilla Sky.
I was going to say, that seems like the next logical thing here, yeah.
And again, Tommy C is a guy who takes a lot of guff from a lot of people.
Yeah.
Who think he's... You know, now it's fine because, like, oh, he's crazy. He's a Scientologist. He jumped on a couch. Or because he can't act. He sucks. Blah, blah, blah. Or, you know, he makes crappy movies like Cocktail and Days of Thunder.
Yeah. And, or he'd be gay or something.
Right. Some of these things are true and some of them are not. Whether or not you really think Tom Cruise is a good actor maybe is beside the point, because, again, Vanilla Sky falls right in and possibly is at the end of the most interesting period in Tom Cruise's career. And it started, you know, it was really only like 2 or 3 years. It was Eyes Wide Shut, Magnolia, Vanilla Sky. And it's sort of this trilogy of movies where Tom Cruise takes all of the public perception of him that he built up over, you know, 15 to 20 years of a career as the biggest movie star in the world, mm-hmm. and takes kind of a sledgehammer to a lot of it, that he uses his public persona against him in all three of those movies. With varying degrees of success. I mean, I like him in all three movies, and those are probably three of my favorite Tom Cruise movies as a result. But it's pretty incredible to me.
Because they're not conventional Tom Cruise movies. Yeah.
Yeah, probably.
I mean, that's the end result, right? I mean,
like, yeah, right. And he's doing something interesting aside from just like, I'm going to get Jack Nicholson to confess. It is amazing to me what he's willing to do, in Vanilla Sky. I mean, he's not a particularly likable guy at any point in the movie, even in the beginning when he's handsome David Ames, charming guy, all movie star smile. He's not a particularly likable guy, and I still even think in his scenes with Penelope Cruz, because of the way I read those scenes, I still feel like he's playing a part. He's playing the part of the interested guy who's intrigued by this earthy bohemian chick. And I do feel like something in him really does change, and he is genuinely interested in her and wants to pursue it. But I think ultimately, you know, she represents something more than she actually is, especially when he has lost her. It's like, oh, that was my chance to be a normal human with emotions and function the way that people have relationships. But to spend half the movie disfigured with a mask on, being this drunk asshole, smothering women with a pillow, tying them up and beating them up. He's really just an asshole. And again, that only works because he's Tom Cruise, I think, and he's willing to sort of destroy that image of himself.
You've laid out all those thoughts in a very clear and eloquent fashion about Tom Cruise, about how this fits into Tom Cruise's career. And I agree, and I was going to say it in just a much sort of simpler way, and it's just that I don't, and again, maybe with the point of hindsight you can think of people, but like at the time when this came out in late 2001, like I don't know if anyone else could even do this, if anyone else A, had the talent to pull it off. And it's not, he's not like Laurence Olivier or something, I understand when I say that, but I mean, for the talent that he does have, the mixture of having the talent to do it, the star image enough to do it, and most important of any of these things, like you said, the willingness to like take those sort of risks. It's fascinating to me the way you said, like the way he used his movie star persona in those three movies that you mentioned, particularly in this one, because he is a guy. This is also the case in Magnolia, but I mean, just like an alpha male, sort of like the kind of man that like other men gravitate to. Mm-hmm. And actually even more so in this movie, because in Magnolia, only men gravitate towards him and women find him disgusting. But here, like everybody is drawn to him in such, and like, and again, this gets back to the way, like the way this whole pop culture stuff fits in there. I mean, I think this is, and again, it's not like they'd worked together before. And I'm sure that he cast Tom Cruise because, you know, he liked working with Tom Cruise on Jerry Maguire and he thought he'd be good for the part. But, like, I think it really says something about, like, taking the world's biggest movie star and making him into a guy, like you said, who's not terribly likable, who does sort of perverse stuff, and yet still at the end of it, you're not apologizing for anything he's done, but you have taken the journey with him and you sort of feel like, well, that actually, like, a lot of that really made sense to me. And I think it's really bold choices on the part of both actor and director. And it's fascinating to watch.
And I will say that I don't really get the feeling, I never feel like, and again, I'm a guy who kind of likes Tom Cruise.
So do I.
Yeah, I think he's a really good movie star, and especially because of stuff like this. It's just like, no, you're willing to do more than just be the world's greatest stock car driver or pilot or bartender or
the cocky young blank who learns lessons about life and love.
That he's willing,
even though he does play a cocky young magazine publisher who learns lessons about life and love.
That he's willing to do stuff like this, but I don't feel like it's a movie star stunt. And by that I mean, I don't feel like the performance ever falls into this, look at what I'm doing. Look at how dark I'm willing to go. I mean, I like Denzel Washington, right? And he won his Oscar for Training Day. But Training Day, I always feel like there's an element of like, this is me doing something that you've never seen me do. I'm playing such a bastard, such a villain, and it's me doing it. And people obviously really fell for that. But I feel like there's there's like a self-awareness to that. That I I don't pick up on in Vanilla Sky, and again, maybe it's because I have an affection for Tom Cruise or because I like the movie or I like Cameron Crowe or whatever, but I don't feel like there's that showy sense of, look at me, look how messed up I'm willing to be for the movie.
Yeah, no, I mean, there is a sense of sincerity about the whole thing. I agree with you. One thing you can say about Tom Cruise, and well, maybe I'm about to say something stupid, but it certainly wouldn't be the first time that that ever happened on this podcast or in my life. But I don't know. I mean, he's, even when he's done like shitty movies, I've never thought of him as a guy who like phoned it in, really. And I mean that with maybe a couple exceptions, but I always find him to at least be like welcoming of the premise, even in a movie. You mentioned Few Good Men. Like, I mean, even in a movie like that, you watch that movie again, that's a completely disposable story that he makes that is watchable to me because I feel like he believes in what he's saying and like approaches the role with vigor, even if it's not a terribly well-written role. And so when he takes that mentality and attaches it to a role that's worthwhile in a story worth consuming, you get this.
Right.
And I mean, I don't know how the rest of his career is going to play out or whatever. I mean, other than, I mean, I don't know how long they're going to keep this Mission Impossible thing going or something, but like, I mean, I don't know. And I mean, I would guess like he's still a fairly young guy. Is he out of his 40s yet or something?
No, I don't think so. I think he's still in his 40s.
I mean, I would imagine like there will be other roles that get thrown his way here that allow him to do stuff like this again. And that is the kind of stuff that like makes me so excited. And like, yeah. We're making Tom Cruise sound like, you know, God's gift to screen acting. And he's not, but like he is nothing if not innately watchable. And
yeah, no, he's a good movie star. And you know,
that's what you've always said. Yeah.
He hasn't yet figured out what kind of roles he's going to age into. He's still sort of trying to play,
yeah,
Tom Cruise roles from like the 90s, and that's why this period was interesting and exciting. It's like, no, he's built up a whole career and he recognizes that now he needs to do something different, and there's only so many times he can sort of play with that image.
Yeah. And then
you got to find something else, and I feel like he sort of went back to what he was doing, like a movie like Night and Day, which reunites him with Cameron Diaz.
Yep.
Is a step backwards for both of them when you watch Vanilla Sky, and you're like, man, yeah, look at the interesting stuff they're doing in this movie. And Night and Day is just, you know, it's supposed to be fun and disposable, and it's definitely disposable. So,
but see, even that movie, like, I mean, did you like? I had a lot of problems with that movie too, but Tom Cruise.
No, he's definitely not one of them.
He's not one of them at all. Like, right. I thought it was really interesting.
Yeah. I always appreciate his crazy drive to drag a movie towards succeeding, even when it shouldn't.
Say.
Just yeah. Like, you don't have to be the one who, you know, rides the motorcycle over the bull or whatever, but like, no, I'm going to do it because I'm Tom Cruise. And there's some craziness in that like, no, I can do anything.
Sure.
But again, you appreciate he does give his all. Yeah, Vanilla Sky is weird because it's a movie for no one, as we're talking about. I mean, Tom Cruise fans will probably be a typical Tom Cruise fan who likes to go see him do what he does and be good looking and smile. You know, who would love Jerry Maguire would go to Vanilla Sky and not like it. Cameron Crowe fans are like, this is not a movie for me. And again, it only exists because Cameron Crowe had the cachet, Tom Cruise was attached. And I think, you know, a movie like The Matrix, which had come out a few years earlier, helped sort of lay the groundwork in studio terms, a studio that can't wrap its head around, wait, what is this? This all exists in some weird fake reality in a guy's head? No,
sure.
It's like The Matrix. Oh, okay, I get it. Sure, go ahead, make your wacky sci-fi movie.
it lays the groundwork for that to be palatable to like mainstream audiences.
Right.
Yeah.
But we should talk maybe for a couple minutes about the ending, because I don't know how much the ending works no matter what, in the original or in the Cameron Crowe version. And again, there's no real change to the end. He pretty much, there's more explanation, you know, Noah Taylor's endless elevator ride, in which he explains everything, is more than we get in Open Your Eyes. But, in both movies, I feel like the ending explains what's been happening without necessarily making it better, if that makes any sense. It's not like I hear the resolution. I hear, no, this is all a dream that's been happening, or half of this has been a dream that's been in your mind for 150 years. It's not like I hear that and I'm forced to reevaluate the movie in a way that, like, oh, this works so much better now. All it does is explain to me why things have been weird.
And that sort of struck me, too, in the sense of, like, I hate to use the, like, the operative word of a twist ending, because it's not really like that. But in the sense of, like, usually movies that have something like that, yes, it gives you some sense of perspective about the things you've seen. If I were to try and assign it some reason, I mean, I guess the resolution is that, like, they're really trying to accentuate to you that it meant that much to him, that's what he chose to live with forever.
Mm-hmm.
If that's enough to hinge a movie upon, maybe not. I don't know. But your critique is well put and accurate, I think.
I almost think more of the movie needed to have taken place in sort of the dream world for some of that to work. Because when you think about it, we don't actually spend that much time in the dream, with the exception of some of those scenes in the beginning of him and Kurt Russell, which we later find out are happening in a dream. So it's like he's flashing back to real life while in a dream with Kurt Russell. It's bizarre when you map it all out. You know, but obviously it's a movie about, you know, regret in a lot of ways. And I think some of that works when you factor in this idea that, you know, he's been out for 150 years. And it's only that last scene between him and Penelope Cruz that sort of drives that home. And again, I love that she plays that whole scene without talking.
Yeah. Well, she says one thing. He says, "I'm frozen and you're dead." And then she says, "It's a problem."
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right.
Which is great. She does say one thing, and it's a perfect thing.
Right.
The other thing that actually always doesn't quite sit well with me is the fact that I don't quite understand the significance of why you can make the argument you have that making half of it like a dream world or whatever is without consequence, really. Even further without consequence is why it all starts going haywire. They just sort of say your subconscious created problems.
Right. It's like this turned into...
We've fixed them.
Right.
And now you're presented with a choice, and then that's where you get that.
But. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And it's like, oh, you started having a nightmare, and now we fixed that. And you're absolutely right. It does seem like, oh, it's just to confuse the audience and what's going on, and why is Julie saying she's Sophia, and he just killed someone, and it was the wrong person, and why, you know, it's like to disorient you for such a long time so that we can get to the end and say, like, no, you were disoriented because you were having a nightmare. Like, that's kind of a bogus explanation. At the same time, I do think the movie is good at placing you in that horrible feeling you have when you're having a nightmare, when you're just – I think it definitely has nightmarish qualities in a way that feels real. And Cameron Crowe points out one possibility on the commentary track, and he says it's not even deliberate, so how much credence can you lend the theory? But – someone else maybe pointed out to him that Tom Cruise's actual life as David Ames was so perfect that he basically was, I think Cameron Crowe's words are, he's living a dream, you know, in his real life. And so when he goes into his lucid dream, he basically has to create problems for himself to have like a real life, to have misery and unhappiness the way that,
normal people do.
So many of us do. Yeah. And again, except for some of the issues like the murder and all that, I get a lot of why a lot of it is obviously him trying to work out some stuff within himself. He's disfigured again in his lucid dream because of the way that he sees himself. And the stuff with Jason Lee, obviously there's residual guilt about the way he treated his friend. And so he's working some of that out within the dream. But you're absolutely right. The explanation is just like, well, no, you had a bad dream, but we fixed it.
The scene that that best accentuates that feeling that you're talking about, but like feeling like a nightmare, is that great scene where he has the – I mean, he's we're couching all this in that he is having a dream the whole time, but he's sleeping and he has a dream. And, you know, he goes in the bathroom and his face is all fucked up.
Yeah.
And then that's a dream.
Right.
Wakes up again. He has that great moment with Penelope Cruz in the bed. He goes back into the bathroom, looks at his face. It's all fine. Goes back. And then they hit you again with the now Cameron Diaz is in the bed. Even now, having seen this movie like probably 7 or 8 times in my life, that always hits me again to the point where it's like, oh, yeah, that's going to happen now.
Right.
And he plays that so well, that horror on his face of just like, what the fuck is going on?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah,
definitely. And it's, you know, it almost becomes funny at some points because of the way he plays it, which I think is right. You know, he doesn't necessarily go for comedy, but sometimes his complete confusion becomes kind of funny. And I think he's aware of that. I mean, I don't think that's unintentional. And if nothing else, you know, Cameron Crowe finally justified the song that plays. It's a monkey song. It's called the Porpoise Song that plays when he's smothering Cameron Diaz / Penelope Cruz. It's from this movie called Head that they did, and it was like, I taped it off of TNT. I'm a huge Monkees fan, and when I was like in high school, I taped it off of TNT because you couldn't get it on video or anything.
Sure? Yeah.
And that was the first time I'd ever heard that song, and I'm like, oh my god, that song is great. That's their, you know, that's their day in the life, or that's their whatever, and that should have been a hit, and why wasn't it? And I loved that song for a long time, and so to hear Cameron Crowe use it in a movie, like, sort of
especially at that moment,
reinforced. I'm like, see, someone with legendary good taste in music validates me liking that song. There's a lot of music, and a little bit, some of it I think becomes intrusive at times. I don't love the use of the Joan Osborne "What If God Was One of Us" when he's on the gurney. I don't like that whole scene. Yeah. And I would say I don't like the Beach Boys at the end, but I get that it's more about, at that point, it's just this crazy whirlwind of pop culture going on, you know? I get why it's there, but I don't think it works as well as maybe Cameron Crowe was hoping.
Yeah, see, I actually like I like that end moment because I value a movie's ability to take a song that I thought I had a handle on and make me listen to it. And then I will never listen to that song the same ever again.
Sure.
And maybe that doesn't mean that it works within the movie like it should, but I give a slow clap to that because that's very admirable, especially for a song like that, that you think is just like, oh, it's good vibrations, whatever. I'll tell you what music cue, and I guess we'll get to wrapping this up fairly soon, but like I tell you what music cue really fucks with me. Before that monkey song kicks in, there's like when they're in bed and he's sort of aggressively having sex with her before he decides to smother her, there's like 4 bars of Jingle Bell Rock play. I mean, what the hell is that?
I don't know. Sometimes I feel like Cameron Crowe is stretching himself in a very valid and believable way. I think this is maybe his best looking movie. I think he does a lot of cool shots. I think the editing is very is more complicated and more interesting than anything he's done before. And then sometimes I feel like he's stretching himself in an artificial way. Again, trying to approximate, like, hey, what would a weird director do here? Oh, let's put a little bit of Jingle Bell Rock in there, you know. And there's not too many instances of that, but every once in a while they jump out at me, and I feel like, no, Cameron Crowe, you're trying too hard.
Yeah,
I don't know.
That's probably a good approximation of a lot of what happens in the movie, that he might be trying too hard sometimes. But overall, I mean, I don't know. It feels like we both. It's something that I will watch at regular intervals for like the rest of my life, really. I mean, not to put too fine a point on it, but like, I mean, it's a movie that every time I watch it, I'm not going to be trite and say like, I notice something new every time. Cause I don't really think I do, but I mean, I think I kind of have a handle on it, but it is something that affects me in a way that few movies do. Every time I watch it on repeat viewings, I would contend it's one of the most rewatchable movies he's made, certainly. And like that I've seen, really, just in the way of it's just so interesting, like you said, even if a lot of it doesn't work. But
it is a great example of that movie that I'm always talking about, that this movie tries something and has ideas. And even if it doesn't all work for you, you have to respect that it's trying from a group of people that didn't need to try necessarily. You know, Cameron Crowe and Tom Cruise didn't need to make this movie for their careers to continue on their successful paths, but I'm glad that they did. If nothing else, you know, because we are fans of Cameron Crowe, it's cool that it exists because it is sort of this one-off. And if you're the kind of person, sure, that sort of likes to look at a director's body of work as a whole, it's neat to see like, oh, and look at this movie that they made where they kind of really try to do something different. And I hope We Bought a Zoo, you know, I don't need it to be Vanilla Sky. I just hope I want it to be like more Jerry Maguire than Elizabethtown. You know, we'll
sure.
see.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We'll see what it ends up being. But where in Cameron Crowe's sort of filmography do you place Vanilla Sky?
It's number two for me.
Behind
Almost Famous.
Okay.
And for as much as I, and it's funny that you ask, and like, cause I asked myself that question. That's when I realized I like Cameron Crowe even maybe more than I thought. Mm-hmm. Cause I just got done saying, I really like Jerry Maguire too. Mm-hmm. And that's probably number four. And that's a movie that I like a lot. Cause number three is probably,
Singles.
It's probably Say Anything.
Yeah.
By the way, I just made a top four list, and at no point did I say the numbers in the order that they go. I think I said my second one first,
fourth one last.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So yeah. I hope everyone kept up with that.
I did. And if not, you know, people can write it out as they listen.
Definitely, it'll definitely. Make sense. So yeah, it's holding strong in the number two spot. And okay, that is a list that is of course subject to change. As we, like I just said, as we grow and, you right. know, whatever, gain perspective or whatever. But how about for you?
My number one actually is still Say Anything, because yeah. I just think it, in some ways it's sort of his least ambitious movie, but I think its scale is so well suited to what he tries to pull off, and that it's just about these three characters, and it's so honest and it's so smart. I think it's his only perfect movie. And I love Almost Famous, but there are things about it that I still could say like, and I don't have any of that with Say Anything. So Almost Famous would probably be around two, and Vanilla Sky would probably be three, because yeah, if I have to choose between that and Jerry Maguire, I'm going to watch Vanilla Sky because it engages me more, because it's trying to do more. So we'll see. And it's cool to me that he made Vanilla Sky so quickly after
yeah,
Almost Famous. Like, it came out the next year, and he used a lot of the same crew, and it was just like, we got to do this. And you could tell that
and it couldn't be more different. I mean, like,
absolutely.
Almost Famous is steeped in nostalgia and, right. you know, reminiscent of a certain time and all that. And like, Vanilla Sky takes place in no time for all intents and purposes.
Right.
But
again, if you do see Abre Los Ojos, you'll see that like, oh, a lot of the work was done for him. I always assumed it was much more of a, to use a douchey phrase, a reimagining of that movie. In many
Christ.
Ways, it's like shot for shot, line for line. It's very similar.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
he adds some more neat touches, like the, you know, the Monet-like skies, in case sure. you didn't know that's what those were.
I don't. We're almost done, and I just wanted to mention one other thing.
Yeah.
And I should have mentioned it when we talked about Cameron Diaz, but we can just move on. Our friend, our mutual friend, Josh Succo, is of the opinion that, you know how you have that moment. God, I forgot her name. What's the name of the character in Pet Sematary that you think is the scariest
Aunt Zelda?
Thing that you ever... Yeah, Aunt Zelda. He is of the opinion. Our friend Josh is of the opinion that the moment when Penelope Cruz wakes him up on the street, and then for a split second it's Cameron Diaz and she says boo.
Mm-hmm.
That's the scariest thing he's ever seen in his entire life.
Well, he's led a charmed life, because if I woke up on a street and Penelope Cruz was waking me up and then quickly changed into Cameron Diaz, but then back to Penelope Cruz, my life has been pretty good, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's all a sense of relativity, I guess. But anyway, I would be remiss if I didn't mention it.
Sure. Scariest thing ever.
Scariest thing he's ever seen. Anyway, the last thing I want to ask you, and just because you carry both perspectives between this and Abre Los Ojos, flat on the line, which one's better?
Oh, gosh. Better for me is Vanilla Sky. Somebody else would give you a different answer, and they would say, no, this one's the original, and this one is more, Abre los Ojos is more of kind of almost a straight science fiction movie, and there's a lot to like about it, but if I'm going to watch one of them again, since they are so similar, I would watch Vanilla Sky. Mostly because I hate reading subtitles. I feel like everyone should speak English.
You beat me to that joke so quickly. God damn. Well, anyway. So everyone, check out Vanilla Sky.
Yeah, if you haven't, or if you have and you're like, I hated that movie, but now you've just listened to us, obviously now you think, I should probably see that movie again.
Give it another look.
And that's the service that we provide here on F This Movie. If you have thoughts on F This Movie or on Vanilla Sky or on Cameron Crowe or on the scariest thing you've ever seen that is Cameron Diaz related, email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. For me, it's her hair in Being John Malkovich.
For me, it's her hair in Something About Mary, but that's, a whole other thing.
That is. All right. Thank you very much, Alex.
Yep. Thanks a lot for having me. Appreciate it.
See you guys soon. And, we're sorry for blowing your minds.
Peace.